80s.
I'm going to call this meeting of the House Early Childhood and Family Supports Committee to order for Thursday, April 20th, 2017. And I'm going to open a informational hearing on pathways from development screening to services. And we have two guests with us today. If you'd please come forward. So Colleen Ruland and Dr. Suzanne Dinsmore. Very good. Welcome. Just introduce yourself for the record. And
sure. Good afternoon, Chair Lively and the members of the committee. For the record, my name is Colleen Ruland, and I am the director of the Oregon Pediatric Improvement Partnership based at Oregon Health and Science University.
Cool. And good day, Chair Lively and representatives and members of the committee. My name is Suzanne Dinsmore. I'm a pediatrician. I work at Childhood Health Associates of Salem here in Salem.
Very good. Thank you. Welcome.
Great. Well, thanks for this opportunity. I am so honored and humbled to be able to share the work that a very large group of folks has been doing around trying to achieve better outcomes for young children. And I am appreciative of all the work each of you do to represent and support young kiddos and the amazing amount of grit. You must have had good early childhood experiences. All right, so what I thought I'd do is just give you a little bit of background about who the Oregon Pediatric Improvement Partnership is. I'm the director of OPIP. And then give some context around the wonderful momentum we have around developmental screening in our state. I know you guys received some primers in past meetings, but I'll just kind of level set because the focus of my presentation is really on the purpose of developmental screening, which is not to screen kids. The purpose of developmental screening is to actually do something so that we can get better outcomes for those kids. And so that's the work we've been doing in three different communities that I'm going to spotlight and share. And then I'll end with some of the learnings we've gathered from this pilot and potential future opportunities for you to consider. So the Oregon Pediatric Improvement Partnership does two things. We, one, support a meaningful collaboration of public-private stakeholders focused on improving health of children. As a staff, we work on projects that are meant to improve and build health for children. So we do quality improvement. We support evidence-guided activities. We have parents involved in every part of our work. And if we do youth-centered work, we have youth involved in every part of our work. And then we try to inform policies to support optimal health. We take a population-based approach, and the reason I want to note that is you are going to see that in this project. So sometimes when people hear Oregon Pediatric Improvement Partnership, they think we only work with pediatricians. But there's a whole bunch of wonderful, amazing providers, both in healthcare and not in healthcare, that care for children. And so that's our lens, is put the child in the center and then think about how we can cut across sectors. We're primarily contract and grant-funded, so the work I'm going to be spotlighting for you is from two different contracts that were provided to us. And we're, again, based at Oregon Health and Science University in the pediatrics department. All right, so let's level set. So developmental screening. You guys got your primer 101, but just in case, developmental screening is the use of a brief standardized questionnaire that checks a child's development. And the goal of developmental screening is to assess the child's development, see the kiddos that you just need to do a little bit of promotion for, but most importantly, to see the kiddos that are at risk for delays. Because there's evidence that if you provide services early, a majority of those kids, you can ameliorate those delays and you can help them be ready for school, but you have to do it early. Within healthcare, there's a recommendation that children should receive developmental screening 3 times in the first 3 years of life. So they should receive it at the 9-month visit, the 18-month visit, and the 24-month visit. And the reason it is 3 different times is children develop at different paces. So a kid that you wouldn't identify at 9 months, you might identify at 18 months, also at 24 months. And the reason it's in the first 3 years of life is what we were finding is we're identifying the kids too late. So when they get identified in kindergarten, that is too late. So the idea is to go where the car seats are parked. So when you think about children under 3, where a majority of car seats are parked is within healthcare. That's where 90% of kids go in the first 3 years of life. So thus the recommendations for doing screening. In Oregon, the most commonly used developmental screening tool is the Ages and Stages Questionnaire. So from here on out, I'm going to use the acronym ASQ. That's what the Ages and Stages questionnaire is. It looks at five different domains of development: communication, gross motor, fine motor, and problem solving.
Yes. Malsprin, did you have a question?
Thank you, Chair Lively. As a person who's done a zillion ASQs with kids, there's two different things you can do. You can have them have the form and fill it out all ahead of time, which is kind of what it's supposed to be.
Yep.
But you can also, as a nurse, I've been with clients at different reading levels, different languages, and filled them out with the client. I mean, you know, just being the kind of the secretary, but making sure they really understood the question, because a lot of times they're a little confused, even though it's very simple. You do get somewhat different results. What are you doing there?
Thank you, Chair Lively and Representative Malmstrom. In terms of primary care, there's a couple ways that they're handling that. So in order to fit it into the workflow, the standard way that they do that is they have parents complete it in the waiting room, and then the family is taken back into the exam room, and sometimes they may need more time. And then as the MA or the nurse, the medical assistant or the nurse is checking them in, the parent will complete it. Then as they're going through and scoring, if there's things that when they then are doing the exam that don't gel, so a common one is the number of steps or ability to step back. And it's not uncommon for a pediatrician or a family medicine physician or a nurse to say, wait a second, I just saw the kid step back. And so there can be adjustments to the score. That being said, it's not they don't have as much time as like a home visiting program or an early Head Start program.
Right.
The goal with developmental screening, though, is to leverage the opportunity that you have there to go for breadth and population base so that you can then refer them on to additional services that may find out, oh, you know what, this kiddo just needs promotion, but they don't necessarily need in-depth follow-up services.
Right.
Is there anything you want to add, Dr. Dinsmore?
No.
Okay.
Follow-up?
Yeah.
My concern with it, and I worked for the health department forever, and we found out that in the clinics, there's so much going on, you know, interrupting, you know, coming in and out, the parents are distracted, and they know this, they think of this as some sort of test, like they almost feel like they're going to fail the test, and they want to put, you know, that they can do everything, because they're not sure what the question means. So if you don't explore that, I mean, if you go line by line, you get a really different responses, and and it's a wonderful teaching tool if you have the time to go through all those things and say, oh, look how Johnny can do this. A lot of times they don't even know that the kid can do it because they haven't done the little test. And then you can relate it to all sorts of safety stuff like, oh, Johnny's, you know, can pull himself up in his crib now. Are you holding the rails up? You know, that kind of stuff. So I don't know. I just saw a lot of mixed results with doing it in a clinic versus a home visit. So I don't know. I just had to throw that out there. We spent a lot of time studying this.
Yeah. I think the big picture of why Bright Futures National Recommendations went down and said this is a recommendation, this is a standard of care, is if we don't have that, what we fall back to is provider gestalt. And validated studies have found that if you use just provider gestalt and developmental surveillance, are they doing this, are they doing this, providers have a 30% accuracy of picking up kids. In standardized validated studies, when you use a standardized tool, you up that to 85%. Is it 100%? No. So what we're seeing is they're identifying between 20 and 22% of kids who are identified at risk on the ages questionnaire, which is a little bit higher than some of the population rates. But again, it's not, it's which pendulum do you want to swing? Do we want to identify them earlier or do we want to miss most of the kids?
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So the great thing about our state, I've been working on developmental screening for over 15 years, and a lot of that work was across the country, and some of that work was in Oregon before the great momentum that a number of you worked on in terms of policy level. So within healthcare, we have a significant change in pace around developmental screening because it is an incentive metric. I developed the measure that is the incentive metric for coordinated care organizations. In the 2017 standards for medical homes in our state, it is now a required must pass. The punchline being, developmental screening rates are only going to go up. And we are actually one of the highest states in the country for doing developmental screening. We're still not at a majority of kids, but we are higher than other states because these policies that you put in place are working. And then secondly, within early learning, we have early learning hub metrics around the CCO incentive metric. And then high quality child care settings are going to start to do child care screenings and ages and stages in a child care setting. So this is the space that OPIP has wanted to then focus on is, well, so what? So you find those kids, now what are you going to do? Because the goal of screening is actually getting them into services. So when I'm talking the rest of the presentation about kiddos identified at risk, what I mean is those kids who are identified at risk for delays. So given that a majority of providers in our state and the early learning has picked the ages and stages questionnaire, what I mean is that those are kids who were found in one domain. So remember, there's five domains. In one domain, there are two standard deviations from normal. Or in two domains, there are 1.5 standard deviations from normal. Okay? So the interesting part about follow-up for developmental screening, particularly follow-up for developmental screening that's happening in primary care, is that the follow-up isn't often in healthcare. The follow-up can be in healthcare. It could be to a developmental pediatrician. It could be for medical therapy services. But often the follow-up is in early intervention, and in our state, in early learning, which requires a cross-sector focus and a knowledge about which kids and where. So that's the great opportunity we've had in our state, is that thank God we have these amazing silos that are being built in our state. Thank God we're having coordinated care organizations developed that are trying to coordinate between physical, mental, and dental health. Thank God we have a state that has a measure around developmental screening. It is why we are one of the highest. We have early learning, which is kind of bundling all these amazing services under one hub, having early learning hubs doing great work of coordinating people. And then we have early intervention. So what we wanted to do was a project that said, okay, given you guys have these shared goals for this very specific population of young children, how can we create some cross-silo work? How do we pass and communicate across these different groups? So thankfully, we received two sources of funding to focus on this. One was from the Oregon Health Authority to support consultation to the Yamhill Early Learning Hub and Yamhill CCO. And we have the director of the Yamhill Early Learning Hub here, Jen Richter. And then we were fortunate enough to receive a subcontract from the Willamette Education Service District. In the 2015 legislative session, there were funds identified for ODE to look at pathways from developmental screening. So what happened is some of those funds went to Willamette Education Service District, and then a component of those funds came to us to facilitate a quality improvement project. So the rest of the presentation, what I'm going to be focusing on is what we found in that work. And so in terms of the communities, it's in Marion, Polk, and Yamhill community that these efforts. Important context is those communities have two different CCOs, two different early learning hubs, but they have one early intervention contractor. So Willamette Education Service District serves Marion, Polk, and Yamhill. So when we set out to do this work, we really thought there were three important parts. One is to actually engage the stakeholders. CCOs are doing a great job of engaging a certain group of stakeholders. Early learning hubs are doing a great job of engaging certain stakeholders. What if you combined those stakeholders, and what if you got more of the frontline engaged? The second is we were really adamant about using data. We have data on this. It's just not connected because it sits in the different silos. And then the third is, based on that data and based on what the community identified, how do we pilot better ways? So our goal was improving the number of children identified at risk that got to the service. So we don't want children to fall out. That's our goal. And so the three places that we piloted improvements were with primary care, with early intervention, and with early learning. So in terms of the stakeholder engagement, we were able to engage 60 different people in Marion, Polk, and Yamhill across six sectors. And what we did is we asked them if they were doing developmental screening, what's your follow-up, who do you refer to, why don't you? And if there are follow-up services, who refers to you, what's your capacity, how can you catch? We then facilitated group-level interviews with folks to have them see and hear from each other their different varied perspective. And it was the first time that these different people had sat at the same table. One of the strengths that we had in this in these three communities is that they have very strong early learning hubs. And so we were able to leverage and build off that table, but add some new people in. And then most importantly, we had parents. We had parents whose children have gone through this and who could tell us what it's like to experience the system and potentially lack of fragmentation and lack of coordination across the system. So the reason I show you this slide, I don't intend you to understand the detail, But when we're trying to think about follow-up for children and why it's not happening, it's because you have to get into the weeds. So what we did is we took those 60 interviews and identified what are the resources that exist for children, and then how do you refer to them? How do you know whether they got there? And how do you know whether they were eligible to get services? So what you'll see is the dotted lines means that they didn't have a standardized way of referring. If there's no line back, that means there was no communication about whether they got there or not, whether they were eligible or not. So the punchline of the slide is there are services out there. We may not fund them to the capacity to be able to provide services to all the children identified, but we have services, but the connectors and the communication between them is the opportunity. So then what we wanted to do is we wanted to look at data because we wanted to focus on the place where do the most children fall out. We only had 13 months for this project, so if we're going to focus on where we're going to go, where are the most kids falling out? So we looked at CCO data, primary care data, and early intervention data. And again, this was the first time that these data had been connected in the community. They had been reviewed in each of the individual silos, but they hadn't been reviewed at a community level. So let me tell you the power of doing that. So when we came into these communities, both CCOs said, we are rocking developmental screening. We don't need to focus on it. And what that meant is, of all the things that they're having to focus on, they are meeting the incentive benchmark. But that also means that a majority of kids still aren't being screened. So the incentive for when we walked into the project was 50%. So this is an example of the CCO in the Marion Polk area. So 48% of kiddos are getting screened. So yes, they were improving. But from an early learning point of view, that is still a majority of kids are not getting screened. And this is just the publicly insured kids. This is not the privately insured kids. The other thing we heard is early intervention reporting, we're getting an increase in referrals. Yes, it's working. We're getting an increase in referrals. But what we wanted to see is, are you having a similar increase in the number of children who are getting services? So again, our point of, is developmental screening to identify kids? Is it to refer kids? Or is it to make sure we get kids into services? So this is comparing on the left is the CCO rate. So that same data I just showed you on the previous slide. So yes, there's been a 79% increase in screening in Marion and Polk County. We now have 50% of kids screened. And yes, early intervention in that area did see an increase in referrals, but it was only 10%. So if children were really being fed into the services, if these kids that we're identifying early, that the whole point of why we're identifying them early is so that they can get services to be ready for school, we're not there yet. So we wanted to understand a little bit more about why. And also, early intervention isn't the only service for these kiddos. There's other services that are really important for kids. How do we take that asset map? Remember that map I showed you? There's a lot of buckets there. But which ones do you refer to and how? So then we looked at practice level data, and this is Suzanne's data. So thank you, Suzanne, for being transparent of your practice level data. So in this one practice, so we are in Marion and Polk. They majority see children from Marion and Polk. In one practice, they did 1,431 screens, which will probably resonate in terms of like number of kids getting home visiting, for example, in that community. Mm-hmm. This is just one practice that's doing that many screens. So of their practice, which is 60% publicly insured, 401 kids were identified at risk for delays. So that's 28% of the screens done identified that kid as being either two standard deviations from normal or two domains, 1.5. So then we looked, okay, well, national recommendations are that all those kids should be referred to early intervention. Let's look. And what we found is that of that 401, 76 were referred to early intervention. So 19% were referred. So just give you a sense of context here. In Marion and Polk, there were 747 referrals in that same time period. So if this practice referred all of those kids, all the 400 and more that I just told you about, one practice alone would contribute to a 44% higher referral rate to early intervention. Just one practice.
Rips them all.
Yes. Quick question. It's interesting because Multnomah County did a lot of the same things and going down the same road.
That was part of that, yeah.
Yeah, but are you, when you're talking about these people, are you filtering out those people that are moved or unable to contact? Because there's a lot of with at-risk families, they're moving around, and how is that fitting into that graphic?
Chair Lively and Representative Malmstrom, I am thrilled that you asked that question because I'd like to show you data about that. Would that be possible for me to show you the data? Okay. Let me just give you context, and then I'll dive into data. I love where you're going. We wanted to look at qualitative, but again, we wanted to look at the data. Like, what does the data tell us? So qualitatively, when we ask people like Suzanne, her colleagues, why aren't you referring? Mm-hmm. One, there was confusion and lack of awareness about the difference between recommendations for when to refer and EI eligibility. They have all experienced that a good chunk of kids they refer are not going to be eligible given our EI eligibility requirements, which are not based on the ages and stages questionnaire domain scores. The second is they said it kind of depends. It depends on, sometimes I find these families that the reason that the kiddo is identified on the ages and stages questionnaire is not a developmental etiology. It's just that the kid's never been exposed to that task. Parents really overprotective and doesn't let the kid crawl up and down stairs. So of course they can't go up and down without holding on to their rail. They acknowledge that there may be other better resources in the community than early intervention. They just don't know what they are. Or they've been briefed on like the kinds of resources that are in the community, but they have no idea which kids to refer. And then most importantly, we're putting all this pressure on practices to be medical homes, which means you are going to track every referral and you are going to make sure that there's closure. And if you don't know how you're going to refer or how you're going to hear back, that puts you on the line to track a referral that you actually can't track. And then lastly, there is parent pushback, particularly since the election, there's been a group of parents that have said, no, I'm not going to early intervention. I do not want to be on any type of list, and I'm not going. So what can we do to support them? How can we expand that? And then we talk to parents, like, why, what are some of the issues here? And parents say, well, there's things I could be doing to promote my kids' development, but I also need education about what these different sources are. Just like it's confusing to providers, it's super confusing to parents. So then we wanted to look at the data. So again, providers said, why would I refer? A majority of kids aren't going to be eligible. So we wanted to look at that. Is that really true that most kids referred aren't eligible? Okay, so blue means good. They got there, or in future slides, they were eligible. Red means we lost them. They dropped out of the pathway. So this first slide is showing you kids referred to early intervention in Marion, Polk, and Yemhill. And what you will see is that 2 in 5 kids never got there. So the provider was thinking they were ineligible, but the reality is they just didn't get there. And the reason they didn't get there was one, parent delay, which often is rooted in lack of understanding. Another one is a good chunk of them couldn't be contacted. A very small percentage, it's parental concerns. And there was a relatively small amount that moved, or there were other big issues about why they didn't get to the evaluation. So if you think about, again, the pathways, where are we losing most kids? We are losing 2 in 4 that they're just not getting to one of the services. I will talk about the value of others. So then of the 60% who got there, how many were then found to be eligible? And what you find is we lose another 2 in 5. So 38% were then not eligible. So when you look at referrals from providers, their general sense of why would I refer, they're never going to be eligible, there is some truth to it in that it's about 7 in 10 of the people they refer don't end up with services. But there's 2 different reasons for that. It's 1, they never even got there, and 2, they weren't eligible.
And why are
you what? Oh, sorry.
Thank you, Chair Lively. On the category of parental delay, trying to sort that out in my head with no contact or no concern, are you saying you're in contact with them, the parents have concerns, but they don't want to do it yet, or they don't have transportation, or what is kind of the general why they don't want to if you're in contact with them?
So, sorry, Chair Lively, Representative Hayden. Per federal regulations, EI has to evaluate that kid within 45 days. So there is a time clock that starts from the start of the referral. So they need to get that kid in 45 days, which would be, you know, like a month and a half. So parent delay is that they're trying to get them in, and the parent can't get in that time period.
But the parent does want, they're interested in the program.
If they were put in the red bucket, it means that there was parent delay and then parent didn't follow up.
Okay.
And what are the, thank you, Mr. Chair, what are the reasons for not being eligible? Just they didn't rank high enough on the, they're not 1.5 or 2.
So this is one of the really important, sorry, Representative Kenny Geyer. This is one of the really important parts of this project that we found confusing. So on the ages and stages side, mm-hmm. in general, you are trained that if a kid is two standard deviations on the ages and stages, mm-hmm. or 1.5 on two ages and stages. Mm-hmm. Within early intervention, it's based on their full evaluation, mm-hmm. and it is based on two standard deviations, but it is on a different tool, and it's based on a more full evaluation assessment. So we already know that there are a group of kids who are identified here who, just by differences in criteria, our state is one of the strictest states in terms of eligibility criteria who will not be eligible on this side. So it's that they got there for the evaluation, and based on the evaluation done by early intervention, they were not eligible.
Representative Malsker.
Thank you, Chair Lively. Just as an interesting note, I realize not all communities have the same services.
Yeah.
But my experience in Multnomah County with the Nurse Family Partnership Program,
yep.
which is a a relationship-based program,
yep.
their referrals to EI and things were very tightly, you yep. know, accepted and followed through. So
yep.
it tells you that's one way. I realize we can't have family partnership in every little town, but, you know, it is one method that really proves when you have that relationship, they follow through.
Yes, Chair Lively and Representative Malmstrom, I would 100% agree with that. I think there's multiple factors in that. One is when you talk to home visiting, early Head Start programs, they also have a better read of which kids are going to be eligible. They also can do the more robust screening. They have more time with that kiddo to do a screen, see, test
yes.
them. Can they actually stack the blocks? Which primary care is not going to have right. the time to do that. And also that kiddo is in a practice that is not a normal situation for them.
Right.
So I also find that they're holding kids until they know. So they have a higher success rate of one referring the right kids because they have more applied experience with a smaller population that they can watch. And then two, they can support that family in making sure that they get to the referral, which is why in the pilots that I'll talk about, it's why we try to add in supports for families right. to kind of close that loop. We don't want that 2 in 5 dropped out. We want to lower that.
Thank you.
Okay, so based on this data, we again brought this to the community and let them pick, okay, where are we going to prioritize our efforts? We can't do everything. We can't do all of those lines. So which line are we going to focus on and how? And so what we decided to do is make sure that we were doing work within each of the silos. So within primary care, how can we do a better follow-up? Just not just the medical and EI, but what's a better sense of follow-up to connect to those other services in that map? And how can we support families better? Within early intervention, how can they do better coordination and communication? And then when they find a kid ineligible, how can they do something to refer that kid to other services? Or how can they communicate back to primary care so primary care even knows to do a secondary step? And then within early learning, we piloted new referrals to new early learning that primary care hadn't known about or hadn't really known which kids to refer to. So again, in terms of the primary care, right now they are trained on if a kid's identified at risk, refer them to medical therapy and early intervention. So in this project, instead, what we did is we broadened that to include 6 priority services that could address the risks that are identified on the ages and stages questionnaire. So yes, medical and therapy and early intervention, but a more refined criteria of which kids you should send. But in addition, in these communities, Cocoon Babies First is actually a good link for certain groups of kids. Centralized home visiting exists in both of these communities, which thankfully that existed in both of these communities because the primary care providers, if you told them to refer to 10 different home visiting programs, I'm not sure we would have had a success, but it was a pretty easy sell to say this is one central referral, these are the criteria. Within these communities, there are amazing parenting classes funded by the Oregon Parenting Education Collaborative, but none of the primary care providers knew what they were. And yet they were a direct link for those kiddos that are identified on ages and stages questionnaire, but it's a lack of exposure issue, who are also probably not going to be eligible for early intervention if you refer them. And then lastly, there's a really important, it is not big, it's a very small percentage of kids who are identified on the ages and stages questionnaire. But the reason they're popping up on the ages and stages questionnaire is they are exposed to trauma and ACEs in their home, and they are appropriately developmentally responding to that. So while we can do some services to help them, we're not actually addressing the root cause of why they're having those delays. So we created a pathway that was around mental health. And then in these communities, we worked with each of those to come up with the straight line. So you can't just tell practices, hey, these are all the services, now go. Because what you will find is they will refer for a month because they'll remember. But what we wanted to do is get very fine-tuned. Which kids, how, and most importantly, how do you refer and how do you hear back? So in these communities, we had amazing partnerships with early learning. So each of those entities, Cocoon, home visiting, parenting classes, mental health, we formalized, like, how would I refer? And then how are we going to communicate back and forth so we can coordinate and manage? And that's not only the first referral, but it's the second. So if I refer to EI and that kid isn't eligible, now I know that I have these other pathways I can put that kiddo on.
Representative Hayden.
You had a question.
Thank you, Chair Lively. On your ages and stages developmentally delayed children,
yeah.
Is that a federal, the 0 through 3 or whatever age category, or is there state flexibility, even though we may not do that, is there state flexibility on that? Say you got a child that is developmentally delayed for physical reasons or social reasons, environmental reasons, and they age out at 3. Do you have any flexibility?
I don't know that answer. Do you mean within which setting? Sorry.
The EI.
There are different criteria between 3 and 5 than there are between 0 and 3.
Yes, but my question is there any overlap?
Between ages and stages criteria and
yes.
EI? Not
I
currently,
mean,
no.
My question is, based on a birth certificate, regardless of their social, physical ability, where they may be getting successful treatment, and all of a sudden the birth certificate says you turn 3, they would automatically be, there's no way for them to continue for some period of time so they can continue those services till they reach a age level of appropriateness 3, not a physical age based on birth date. There's no overlap there. Is that what you're telling me?
Nancy, do you want to answer this? This is the director of the EI ECSE program.
If you would identify yourself.
Representative Lively, I'm Nancy Johnson-Dorn, the director of the Early Intervention, Early Childhood Special Education Program. And in Oregon, we have a seamless program that is birth to school age. And so there is different criteria for kids when they turn 3. For the 3 to 5-year-old group, but about 80 to 85% of the children do continue with early childhood special education services, and we do try to continue the services that are most successful with those kids.
But that's not my question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Question is, the services, the 0 through 3 and the 3 through 5, or the 4 through 5, are compartmentally kind of different services, right? I mean, they're not a smooth transition. I mean, you kind of get moved to a different bucket, if you will, right? The question is there overlap between those buckets if you have somebody that's in a successfully EI 0 through 3 and that child would benefit from being there 6 more months? Is that a federal regulation that they stop one bucket at 3, or is that a state decision?
Representative Lively, Representative Hayden, there is crossover in our program because it is a seamless system. And if a child is being successful at age 3 and they still, but they qualify for early childhood special education, then their services would continue. And we have flexibility in our state to make sure that those services are the same. The differences between the programs, between early intervention and early childhood special education, is at a federal level. And in Oregon, we try to minimize that by having one system, a single system of services for kids. Did I get to it? I don't think I'm getting to it.
You didn't quite get there. So let's move to the next category from 4 to 5, if you will.
You want to? You can
want a chair?
Yeah. A chair right over there so you don't have to
really
break your neck.
If you move from 4 to 5 and that student doesn't enter K through 12, is there any overlap there?
At age 5, when kids are eligible for kindergarten, they then become the responsibility of the school district. Early childhood special education doesn't have responsibility anymore.
But the question is that a federal decision or is that a state decision? That's the question.
Representative Lively, Representative Hayden, that would be a state decision. Services for children 3 to 21 are special education services, and in most states, those services are provided by the school district. And in our state, we break it into a 3 to 5 and 5 to 21.
Okay. That's what you're getting
at. That's what I was getting at. Thank you.
Sorry.
Took a while, but we got there.
Well, just to kind of add on to what she kind of nailed it at the end, there's the Cocoon program that follows children clear up to age 21 from birth to 21. So that is a continuous spectrum sort of program. So
if upheld in the counties and
right.
funded.
Right.
Yep. Okay. So, again, in terms of the kind of new innovation piloted in primary care practices, what we did is we gave them a more refined and specific medical decision tree of which kids you should refer to developmental pediatricians, which kids you should refer to early intervention. The developmental pediatrician one was really important because we're still seeing kids with autism and intellectual disability referred too late. And part of that is they are in that group, that 81% of kids that they didn't refer, they're in there. And so what we wanted to do is kind of help give better criteria. And then now all the services, mental health, Cocoon, centralized home visiting, parenting classes, those are additional or separate services that the kiddo may be referred to. And we gave them very specific criteria of based on the ages and stages questionnaire, but also based on child and family factors, which kids would you refer and how and why? One of the other things, and hearing from parents, they said, it is so confusing. I just went to this appointment, and then I heard this, and then all of a sudden some school district is calling me or a home visiting program is calling me. I don't understand what just happened. And when we looked, there was great materials about developmental screening, but there was none in the community about what happened if your kid got identified on developmental screening. So what providers were doing is they were giving information about each of the programs, so giving them the early intervention packet, giving them the home visiting cocoon packet, but there was nothing that summarized it for the family into one place of this is what you can expect, this is what just happened, this is why this is important. Again, getting at this parent delay, to some degree we're saying, the parents aren't playing along, they're not playing the game. But on the other hand, it's like, well, we didn't even tell them the game. We didn't even prepare them.
Absolutely.
What's been really cool about so parents told us how to do this. Parents informed us on how to do this. What has been very cool from the provider angle is it's actually for shared decision making. So rather than me telling you which services you should go to, it's a joint conversation of what do we think is best for your kid? And what we're starting to see is we're already seeing an uptake in services. So we're hoping that by the end of the project, we're going to see a reduction in that 2 in 5 loss because there's just better education information. And with each one, here's a phone number you can call. If you have questions, this is how you can contact me. So preliminary findings from our pilot sites, and then I'll let Suzanne actually share her own frontline experience, is that it's working. There is enhanced collaboration and coordination. We have an amazing group of people in these three communities that care deeply about young children. The tools and resources have been more effective in a family-centered approach to referrals. And it has filled a need about which kids. I will say, because we're referring more kids, guess what's happening? We have more kids not eligible for early intervention. Because we're referring more kids to home visiting and mental health services, guess what's happening? We have more kids not able to be served by those programs because just in this pilot of three really big practices, we're already starting to swamp the system. But the screening requirement is not going away. Practices are continuing to be asked. The benchmark just got raised to 60%. So we are doing a fantastic job of identifying more people. And what we're finding is as we get them to the right services, those services aren't able to catch the people robustly that we're trying to pass to them. And then the last thing is that there is a huge disparity for the publicly insured versus privately insured. If you think about those pathways, Cocoon has a medical diagnosis criteria, but they can't get reimbursed for care coordination for people privately insured. Home visiting has to prioritize, and that prioritization takes into account poverty. And then mental health services in private insured policies can be quite weak. So there's a whole group, and actually it's a majority of the kids that practices are identifying who are going to be going to school. All those privately insured kids are going to be going to school, that those pathways just don't exist for them, or they exist in a way that somebody's going to have to pay $5,000 for OTPT for a kid in order to bump them up. And that's something that most of these families can't support. All right, so now I'm going to pack to Dr. Dinsmore to share her experience.
So we were really lucky to be able to partnership with OPIP in this project. It allowed us to learn a lot of things about ourselves and a lot of things that we can do to improve care for the kids in our practice. So one of the things that we did was to examine our practice level data and discover that we were not referring a majority of kids that we screened, that actually we probably could have screened or referred for many different reasons. But that was very humbling and enlightening. And I think data is just really important in telling you what direction you should go with your dollars or your efforts or whatever. We also educated our providers on the algorithm, the referral algorithm that OPIP had developed. If you thought that that first chart was really confusing, the flow chart, imagine that you're in the midst of a 10-minute visit with a family and remembering all those arrows and all the directions that you could send a child. It's difficult. And so the algorithm that they developed was, I think, a really good tool for our community in that it directed kids who were at risk to what community resources would best suit their needs. And so I think educating providers on that tool has been really helpful. We have also refined our process for EI referrals in that we have, we're calling all families a couple days after the referral's been made to try and get the families to understand more why we're doing that. And then lastly, we're using the parent support tool that she showed you in the context of our, you know, short visits with families to let them know where we're sending them. I think that this process also allowed us to understand what the early learning system had to offer our patients. I think, and so we're working in our practice to incorporate these improvements, and I think as we do that, the result for the early learning system is that there are going to be more referrals because we're going to do a better job of screening kids and developing, you know, ideas about which kids would be best served. So I think that there have been several learnings for ourselves as pediatricians in my practice. And one is that we have, we've always realized that we see patients and kids many, many times in the course of the first 2 years of life. We have at least 11 visits that we see them just for well child care. And that gives us lots of opportunities to do our screenings and refer patients and kids and families to the appropriate places in the community, whether it's EI or medical services like PT, OT, speech, developmental pediatricians, or to some of these other community services. So I think that as pediatricians, we can contribute a lot to the appropriate development and literacy, actually, of kids in the first 3 to 5 years of life. I think developing acquiring data, as Colleen and her group has done, is really important in letting us know what we can do better, and also in terms of yourselves, in terms of where you should best direct your dollars, what gives you the most bang for your buck. Because I think we all know data is showing that the more ready kids are for kindergarten, that really determines both health and education trajectories, perhaps for the rest of their lives. And so it really behooves us to really focus on these kids in 0 to 3, 0 to 5, in those pre-kindergarten years. However, screening right now doesn't mean that these kids always get intervention. And so that's something that, you know, I hope that you guys take away and think about as you're dealing with budget issues. Let's see, what else? And then there is a difference between kids who are on the Oregon Health Plan and kids who are privately insured. I think the state should be proud of the coverage that it gives kids, because I think in many ways it provides better service for kids than kids who are on private insurance, because parents have to pay a copay every time they go to PT or OT or speech. And I've seen many families with kids who have Down syndrome or other significant developmental delays who don't get services for their kids because they don't have the money, although they do have insurance. So I just think those were some of the learnings that we took away from the project.
Very good.
And really appreciate your help.
Thank you.
One other thing that is starting to come up that is an opportunity is that there are a group of families who would benefit immensely from home visiting services, but they're not willing to have home visiting come to their home. And particularly right now, where there's somewhat of a fear. There are some national models that have shown that if you have those home visiting services co-located in primary care, you can establish a warm handoff and you can establish a trust that then they do let you have them come to their home. And so in kind of thinking big and broad, that may be an avenue by which we get the most vulnerable families to receive services, because there's less of a stigma and less of a fear about it.
Let me say one thing.
Please do.
We've just found in our practice, we've integrated mental health services into our practice. We now have 2 child and adolescent psychologists, and we have 4 doctoral students who are there every day of the week working with us from 8 in the morning until 8 in the evening, accepting the students. They're not there the whole time, but the others are. And families are much more willing to seek mental health services if it's offered in the context of their pediatrician's office. It just feels like a place that they're familiar with. It's not stigmatizing, and they're willing to take those services. We, in the past year, have hired a social worker also, who I think can develop relationships with families in the context of our office, and then they feel comfortable in letting her go out into their home and help them with whatever resources they might need.
Okay. So unfortunately, we're running out of time.
Yep.
Because people have to be back on the floor, so if you just can...
No problem. Go ahead.
Quick question.
I mean, this is great information.
Yeah.
You put me on this committee. Okay. Thank you, Chair Lively. So I want to get clear in my head. I love this subject, but I want to get clear in my head. So you're saying if they're OHP, you're talking about the CHIPS 300% federal poverty level? So if their family is standard population, they would still get that up to 300%, right? So in our education system, we don't have residency requirement. In the 0 through 5, do the undocumented children get access to that?
Access to health care?
Access to the EI, access to these programs. Because under...
I don't know the answer to that.
Under the OHP, they may not have access to OHP just because of their documentation status.
Yeah, yeah.
But once they get to the K through 12, they do, right?
Yeah.
Regardless of 5 years or not. So my question is, in that 0 through 3, do they have access to that under the health plan?
I don't know the answer to that.
I don't know the answer to that. I can follow up and get you the answer for each of those services.
What's that?
For each of the services.
Yes. Yes.
I
understand that counties can make exceptions to those rules, but I actually don't know what the...
That's a great question. Yep. Okay, so punchline is you don't have to build new silos or new trains in our state. So that's the strength base, right? You have them. You've already been pushing on them. What we need to do is connect them and maybe support them to catch the people that we're connecting. So we need to have all children screened. A benchmark of 60% is fantastic, but if we're really going to be successful at catching kids early, we got to get that up. Gains in developmental screening do not equal receipt of services. So we need to increase, the measure has created a focus. So we need to create another set of measures that create a focus on the follow-up. Each of these services, developmental pediatrician, the wait list for developmental pediatricians is quite long. Early intervention, you just saw how many. Home visiting, mental health, parenting support. So all of these are the things that are going to catch those kids. We need to think about funding and capacity. And then lastly, just a plug, early learning hubs are fantastic. I can't reiterate enough how wonderful they were in these two communities. That being said, they are not sufficient to achieve the work that I'm talking about. They are one of the silos, but they are not. It would not be fair to put on them to coach and train primary care practices. So we need that silo to be stable and strong, but we also need the cross-sector work. And that's it.
Great.
I want to
thank you very much.
Thank you for
your time. I apologize for not having more time, but this is great. Great discussion, great information. More of us we can talk about, and we may have more questions.
Sounds great. Doors always open.
Thank you
very
much.
And I will get back to you.
Thank you.
Yes. Doors always open.
Thank you.
And I will get back to you.
Thank you.
Yes.